Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Clovis Oncology, we pass the mic to Bradley J. Monk, MD, FACOG, FACS, Professor and Director of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at Creighton University of Medicine at St. Joseph's Hospital and Medical Center, Arizona Oncology, and Thomas Herzog, MD, a Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Deputy Director at the University of Cincinnati Cancer Institute, to discuss the use of PARP inhibitors in patients with BRCA-positive ovarian cancer. In our exclusive interview, Monk and Herzog discuss the importance of molecular testing in ovarian cancer, the utility of PARP inhibitor maintenance and treatment, and potential sequencing and combination strategies under investigation.
Greetings and welcome. My name is Brad Monk. I'm a gynecologic oncologist from the University of Arizona here in Phoenix and part of US Oncology. I'm joined here by my good friend Tom Herzog to share with you a brief podcast about PARP inhibitors. Tom, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm the deputy director of the Cancer Center at University of Cincinnati, my hometown. So I came back from New York now almost 7 years ago. So it's been some time. Before that, I was at Washington University. Here, I'm a GYN oncologist, but as I said, also deputy director of the Cancer Center. So very involved in clinical trials for not only gynecologic cancer, but for the entire Cancer Center. And then I get to serve with you and under you for the GOG Partners as associate director and one of the co-directors, which has also been an amazing experience in terms of the amount of really good clinical trials that we've brought to investigators and in turn have brought great drugs to patients. So I think that's been a really rewarding experience.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm very grateful for your hard work, both for your patients, for your friendship, for what you do for the Cancer Center and the GOG in general. So let's begin by talking about BRCA. Why is it important to test for BRCA, germline mutations, in all patients with epithelial ovarian cancer? Why does the NCCN, SGO, and ASCO recommend that?
It's really important on a number of levels. And the first one really is that it gives us information about not only the patient, but her family. And that's incredibly important because it may be the only opportunity we have to save multiple lives in a family with one intervention, if you think about it. And I think cascade testing often gets, you know, we get caught up in, well, do we really need this? Do we need this molecular test and so forth? I think not testing for BRCA and ovarian cancer really is problematic on a number of levels. First one really being that cascade testing, that opportunity to be able to capture these patients. And a lot of people try to use the red flag strategy where they try to identify patients who in their mind are at higher risk, older women, women who have a strong family history, that type of thing. And what we found is that irrespective of that, while the rates may be a little bit higher, you can't discriminate confidently from those who actually don't have a BRCA mutation. So it's really important that we check for the purpose of knowing what's going on within the family. Second purpose is prognosis, so we really can counsel the patient better in terms of prognosis. And then the third one, which is new, which is exciting, is that we now have treatment options that I think have totally changed the landscape for patients with mutations, so PARP inhibitors in particular. And I think that that's been something that has really been remarkable. And so there's some pretty powerful reasons there to do BRCA testing. And in fact, all the major organizations, NCCN, ASCO, SGO, and so forth, all recommend BRCA testing be done for epithelial ovarian cancers.
Thank you. So as you know, and as our listeners know, we've been on this wild ride of PARP inhibitors. The first PARP inhibitor to be approved was olaparib in 2014. Since then, we have 9 ovarian indications. We also have 3 additional tumor types, prostate, pancreatic, and breast cancer. So we have 4 tumor types, 9 in ovary. I think what's most interesting now is the upfront use of PARP inhibitors. In December of 2019, we got SOLO-1 olaparib approved in BRCA-mutated patients. So Tom, to your point, not just germline testing, but tumor testing, because the germline is about, you know, 15 to 18% and then we can test another, you know, 5 to 10% of somatic. So we got to test both generally, unless of course she has germline. If she's just germline, then you got a lab or a maintenance opportunity anyways. But tell us about this trial PRIMA, which tried to go beyond BRCA, and what that has brought to the table since FDA approval in April of last year.
The intro to all this was SOLO-1, where we looked only in patients who had BRCA. The question was, well, I think everybody in the field saw the remarkable data that came from that, and everybody was very excited. But what I think the question was then is, could you do the same thing by looking at a more broad population? And so PRIMA did just that. They looked at patients that had newly diagnosed ovarian cancer who were at high risk of recurrence in frontline therapy. They randomized 2-to-1 to niraparib maintenance versus placebo. Primary endpoint was BICR determined progression-free survival, and they looked at overall survival in the usual quadrant of secondary endpoints. What was interesting is they used the hierarchical testing where they looked at those who had homologous recombination deficiency as their first statistical look. And if that was positive, they then moved on to the overall population. And then, of course, reported out their subgroups as well. The other things that I thought were interesting about this trial were that it was the first time that they prospectively implemented the weights and plates. So about 2/3 through the trial, they implemented the weights and plates, which is a way of mitigating thrombocytopenia toxicity that was seen with niraparib from earlier trials. And the other thing that they did, which probably helped get them across the finish line a bit faster, was for those that had primary cytoreduction, they had to have some residual disease. So it was a particularly high-risk group. So I think people need to be cognizant of that when they're looking at median progression-free survival, because those can be deflated a bit by the patient population that we're looking at. They used the Myriad My Choice in terms of measuring for homologous recombination deficiency, and they used a cutoff of 42. And for those that had the HR deficient, they found that they had a hazard ratio of 0.43, so a 57% reduction in the risk of progression and death. So it was really remarkable. And if you look at the curves, they don't even come together at the end. So pretty impressive. Median survival more than doubled. It went from 10.4 in the placebo group to 21.9 months in median PFF. So that was very exciting. And obviously, the benefit was not as great in the overall population, where the HR was 0.62, but the confidence interval didn't cross 1. So that was encouraging. And then the subgroup analysis, interestingly, showed obviously a great effect in the BRCA mutant population, but also the group that was HRD but had BRCA wild type. And then the real interesting subgroup with this that's controversial, of course, is the HR proficient group. And in this group, they had a hazard ratio that was 0.68 that did not cross 1, although fairly close, but the median improvement in PFS was only 2.7 months. So lots of ways of looking at that cohort in terms of what you're going to do with it. And I always like looking at the data myself, because I feel knowledge is power, but you could argue bad data is worse than no data. So I understand the argument.
I mean, I love hearing you tell the story that, you know, SOLO-1, olaparib in the BRCA mutated cohort was great. But let's go to work on the highest unmet need, the stage 4's neoadjuvants residual disease. Let's go beyond BRCA and let's change the dose. And let's do it with your leadership and others in the GOG in collaboration with Europe. And you, we did it.
Well, Brad, with your leadership, we went from getting the trial through to completed in how long?
37 months. It's unprecedented. I am proud of that, because you and I and the rest of our specialty, not just us, changed the world for 3 years.
Yeah, well, I've seen concepts languish that long.
Well, we're lucky and we're blessed that we have such passionate clinical trialists. So in this group that doesn't have the HRD molecular signature, okay, we had an option, bevacizumab, which we still have today, which also you're a part of, leading to FDA approval in 2008. So we had Bev in 2008, 2019 SOLO-1 olaparib BRCA, and then 2020 PRIMA all comers. In that HRP subset, the group that does not have this molecular signature, Myriad My Choice, which is a tumor test, is Bev the right medication, or is niraparib the best medication? And I'm putting you on the spot because that's the question that I get asked. And I like to hear you tell these stories.
I guess a little bit of it starts with the first decision point as you work your way back mm-hmm. to the clinic. So the first one is really, when am I going to operate? Do I have a firm diagnosis of epithelial ovarian cancer? And then the next decision is, am I going to use bevacizumab with chemotherapy or not? Whether that's in the neoadjuvant setting or not. And so that, to me, sets up things a little bit differently. And I know a lot of people vary on what their criteria are for introducing Bev to patients in frontline settings. Some people never use it virtually. I think that's a very small minority. Some who use it in almost everybody. And then there's people like me that sort of pick and choose, and I don't know if the data really even supports that. If you look at some of the low-risk, high-risk strata that have come out, you question whether we really understand this concept of low-risk advanced ovarian cancer. And so I think that's really the challenge, is to have a criteria within your mind as to when you're going to use Bev. And then that, to me, informs what you're going to do. So if I'm using Bev, would you ever add niraparib to it? Well, by label, no, but you could certainly consider doing that. And we certainly have data from Avario and others that promising putting the combination together. But we do have good data on Bev with a PARP inhibitor in the case of olaparib. So we have pretty good data on that from the PAOLA-1 trial. And so, you know, which is the best to do in the HR proficient, I think, is a challenge. And you can look at trials and say that the hazard ratios are very close. It was a 0.68 for Bev. There you are. Same. With niraparib. Mediums are slightly higher with Bev, but it's tough to say. What I would say is that I think the standard has changed from observation patients to maintenance in virtually all patients who are fit.
Yeah, thank you for that. So just to summarize, so once you start Bev, and if it's working, you're not going to stop it. Yeah. And if she's HR proficient, the Myriad My Choice tumor test, you're going to continue it. And if she is HR deficient, you're going to add olaparib as per the PAOLA-1 study, which was FDA approved on May 8th, 2020. That makes sense. And if you don't do Bev and she's HRP, then okay, you can continue niraparib if you want. It would be a shared decision making.
It's about telling the patient about, you know, here's the data. I do think there's some patients, you know, how did you get there? There's probably some patients clearly benefit, and those are patients that actually do have HRD, but they were missing the interview, so a false negative, if you will. And if you truly are HRD, you're probably not going to benefit.
So, and if you're HRD non-BRCA, then the only opportunity is niraparib, assuming you're not on Bev. Again, HRD is both BRCA and non-BRCA. So I wanted to finish with another tough question. In the recurrent platinum-sensitive maintenance, we have all three PARP inhibitors approved, niraparib, rucaparib, and olaparib. And so we've had a lot of conversation, what's the preferred PARP inhibitor? We still have that conversation even now in the frontline BRCA mutated cohort, again, without bevacizumab. So if a patient has a germline or somatic BRCA mutation, and you're not on bevacizumab, you have to make the decision, olaparib, SOLO-1, or niraparib, PRIMA. Again, another tough question, but again, these are real-time sort of practical. We're comfortable sort of thinking about that in a recurrence, but we still have to make which PARP inhibitor decisions frontline in the BRCA mutated. SOLO-1, olaparib, or PRIMA, niraparib. How do you make that decision if you pop a BRCA mutation, either germline or somatic, and you're not using Bev? Olaparib or niraparib, frontline BRCA.
What most people are doing, if you look at, you know, you and I are both involved with symposia and so forth, where we get audience feedback. Most of what I've seen is that there's a halo effect from SOLO-1 because it made such an impact, and it was the first PARP approved. I think especially with medical oncologists who use it in multiple tumor types, there's a familiarity there. So I see quite a bit of use with BRCA. So I think people identify olaparib with BRCA in that population, citing the SOLO-1. And in all fairness, you know, it was a large phase 3 trial dedicated to those patients. So, you know, the effect is quite amazing. The morphology of those curves is really impressive in terms of the separation and how they stay separated. fact, surprising to me was how fast the control arm, which are patients who have the mutation, actually recurred. That was interesting. For BRCA, for me, probably a olaparib. I think the real question is, do you need to add BEV? Do you have a presentation, propensity weighted, which is a little bit of a black box statistically in terms of knowing exactly what's going on, but it is a legitimate statistical exercise. However, there are assumptions made which gives rise to error. So yeah. How well that's done, it's hard to say. But the winning arm there was olaparib with BEV. Yay, right? Which you wouldn't have thought BRCA, the olaparib, which works directly on the pathways that you think are so important in BRCA, would be the most impactful drug. But yet BEV seemed to have a major effect.
Well, there's an additive effect. And to your point, if you're given BEV and it's working and she's BRCA, why stop it? Just add a olaparib to it.
Additive up front, you know, raises the question, could you potentially in a small percentage result in more cures, you know, and
we'll see.
Long-term to revival.
So these PARP inhibitors are not the same. The olaparib is once daily. It's more lipophilic, might even have more tissue concentration. The BRCA1 gene is tougher to treat. And that the BRCA2 patients are easier. And in fact, you see that in SOLO1, that there is more activity in BRCA2 mutated patients than BRCA1. So
PRIMA data showed they were pretty similar.
That's my point. So if she has a BRCA1 mutation, which is the 2/3 of the BRCA mutation, I kind of prefer an olaparib because I think it might be a little bit more effective based on the biology, but how would I know? What do you think about that argument?
All the preclinical data resonates. What I'm struck by, though, is the closeness of these hazard ratios, when they really look like you're comparing apples to apples, which is very few of these studies, by the way. But in that platinum-sensitive group, you know, Ariel 3, Nova, I think you can compare pretty closely. There's some differences there, but pretty similar clinical things. And so maybe there might be some patients that benefit. It's not enough to show up.
Yeah, Tom Herzog's very respectful to me. We've been friends for many years. But this is what he would say. He said, Brad, you're doing it again. I'm like, what are you about? He says, you're taking a hypothesis, generating conclusion, doing an inappropriate cross-trial comparison, and making an opinion.
Yeah, you do it so well.
So anyway, it's been fun, Tom. Good sharing some time. I'll give you the last word.
Well, I just think that we've really changed the standard of care for ovarian cancer. And I think there's things we need to watch out for a little bit. We've seen this long-term results from SOLO2 in the platinum-sensitive group. The good news on that was a really robust advantage in overall survival and a statistically significant improvement in overall survival. The bad news was we've always quoted 1 to 2% MDS AML for these patients. And in this cohort, they had 8%, but you could argue they've just had a lot more platinum, had a lot more DNA damaging drugs. So you kept them alive longer, so they kept staying platinum sensitive. They got a lot more of those drugs. So we're going to have to sort all that out. But I will say, you know, I don't know if we're going to get an OS or not, for example, in SOLO 1. To me, that would really be transformative. And the real question is, even if it's a handful, are we curing more women with ovarian cancer? And so we need to look at combinations of these drugs, which we are. As you know, we continue to look at anti-angiogenics, which we talked about. You know, and certainly was well illustrated in Palo 1 with olaparib and BEV. But beyond that, we're looking at IOs, you know, oncology drugs, which is, by themselves have not been a home run in ovarian cancer. You've led Javelin 200, and there's Javelin 100, and then we've had the Imagine 50 data that came out in frontline recently that were all negative trials implementing either a PD-1 or PD-L1. So we've got a ways to go, in my opinion, on IOs. These are relatively cold tumors, and I think we need to make them hot before the IOs really are very effective. And so would PARPs plus IOs be more effective with increasing tumor mutational burden? Those are the types of preclinical hypotheses that are out there right now. So we have a number of studies that answer that, including Athena, which I know you're the study chair for in the United States. And so we're going to have some great data coming out. So it's exciting times in GYN oncology. I remember 8 years ago, we were begging people to do studies in GYN malignancies. And now we have a plethora of really wonderful drugs that are under investigation that I hope will translate into better survival for our patients.
So thanks, Tom, for giving us a fair and balanced opinion. I've enjoyed sharing my opinions with you as well. On behalf of Tom Herzog, I'm Brad Monk. Thank you for sharing time with us today, and so long for now.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave on Air, sponsored by Clovis Oncology. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science Summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave on Air.